time, it also has been something they love. But I need the freedom not to feel handcuffed by their expectations. Don't get me wrong, there were certainly troubles during the dynasty era. Ace's alcoholism and drug use were out of control, so he was no longer reliable. Peter's drumming was substandard enough that the producer he had worked with on his solo album, whom we hired for Dynasty, didn't let Peter play on the album. Gene's focus was clearly on pursuing a career in Hollywood and left little room for making Kiss his priority. I was more focused on serial dating and a never-ending shopping spree rather than writing the kinds of songs that celebrated a life I now saw only in the rearview mirror of my newly purchased Mercedes. The band was so splintered and dysfunctional that Dynasty was the result of all those components, good and bad. But I wasn't manipulated, coerced, or strong-armed during the making of Dynasty, Unmasked, or The Elder. I made decisions based on my life at that point. I don't think they were the wrong decisions. They were necessary at that time. I needed to do Shandy. We needed to make The Elder. After all, these decisions got me to where I am now. Even so, in anything we do, me or anyone else, we have to be able to take a breath, step back, and ask, is this good? Which is not the same as asking, does someone else think this is good? I'm talking about a gut check, an honest assessment. We lose the plot when we try to please other people instead of making it the priority to please ourselves. In the case of The Elder, it was a desperate attempt to seek validation from people who would never give Kiss that validation. So at some point after that album, I felt almost like when I'm in a car and mindlessly driving, only to find myself wondering, where the fuck am I? When did I take the wrong turn? How did I get here? Perhaps The Elder proves that the most effective motivation has to come from within. When we do things to placate others or for someone else's agenda, it's pretty hollow. If I'm going to fall on my ass, I'd rather do it while doing something I feel compelled to do rather than while doing something someone else wants to do. Kiss was lost, and we had forgotten who we were and why we were. As we had with Destroyer, we looked to the producer, Bob Ezrin, to guide us, in part because he'd done a brilliant job on Destroyer. If he didn't exactly abandon ship during the making of The Elder, he certainly took a lot of shore leave, meaning we were without a captain a lot of the time. Much like with Destroyer, we were in uncharted waters during The Elder, but this time, we had nobody to guide us. We tried the best we could, and we're sincere, but we were deluded and tainted by our success. Our achievements didn't spur us on to be better at who we were and what we were doing. Our achievements gave us license to do less. Success gives everyone the opportunity either to sit back and get fat or to grab the next rung of the ladder. And that's where we failed. We began to get complacent and lazy, and we lost the hunger. I'm not even sure hunger is a good word, because hunger implies that you need to be starving to have desire. Hunger shouldn't just come from starving, it should come from wanting more, wanting to raise the bar, as opposed to sitting back and wallowing in your achievements. If someone becomes successful, that literal hunger is gone, but creative hunger, and hunger for ideals and standards, should never be gone. We were no longer in the first blush of success, and we had become complacent with success. I was dealing with having money to buy things, with security guys, and this changed the way I saw things for a while. People may sometimes lose sight of all the complicated elements that contribute to a situation. Kiss not only had fame and a certain new desire for validation from our peers, we also had a need for validation from our little sycophantic support groups. For so many reasons, we found ourselves leaving behind the music that had been made by four hungry guys who had wanted to take over the world. In a sense, we felt we had accomplished that. and didn't know what to do next. None of us had any desire to make a hard rock album or a heavy album. Ace might say he wanted to do it at that time, but that's like me saying I wanted to fly. We can't fly without wings. Ace was totally inebriated, so yes, he may have wanted to make a hard rock album, but he wasn't capable of doing it. We shrugged our shoulders and got excited with something that, in some ways, was easier for us to do. Use a very familiar outline, used 100 times before, and go in a different direction with it because we didn't have the chops or the teeth to do what we needed to do. But hey, even passive decisions are decisions. If you do nothing, you've still made a decision. Nobody should ever kid themselves. We took the path of least resistance, which is not that different from surrendering. It would have been more of a challenge to make a hard rock album. That would have taken a lot of effort. At the end of the day, we were half-assing the work. I'm all for exploring different avenues, but it's important to do it from a position of strength and excitement as opposed from being dazed. That's just wandering onto a path. It's just as easy to wander off a cliff. That being said, everybody's vision was clouded, and what we did was misguided and of our own doing. For me to sing some pseudo-opera tune like Odyssey with a bogus Broadway voice reminds me of Alfalfa singing I'm in the Mood for Love in The Little Rascals. But anyway, it started from the wrong place. It started with the wrong reasons. There was no righting the ship. Our choices flow from always having a reason why we do things. We question ourselves, question our foundations. Why are we doing this? Is this the right thing to do? I guess one thing I can say in defense of the elder is that we were not content merely to keep doing what we had already done. Nobody can recreate the past. The past is spontaneous and honest, whereas in any creative outlet, to try to recreate spontaneity is forced. It's the antithesis of where we came from, which was a place of innocence, and oftentimes creating by what we didn't know. Trying to fake that would have been impossible. All the things that turned out to be problematic or distractions were the things that went along with success. Enablers, people to open the doors. We wanted bigger, broader success, though in the end we found out that all those things were detrimental to the success of KISS. But we had to attain the success to realize that. We had to do it all. We were compelled to do it. We needed to. Besides, I couldn't have written 100,000 years at that point. I was still searching. Fortunately, as my mom always used to say, nothing bad ever happens. After all, Creatures of the Night couldn't have happened if it weren't for our No Rules and No Boundaries manifesto and an attempt to reclaim our identity, if not recreate who we had been, at least reconnect with the reasons we had been. Creatures was the pendulum swinging all the way in the other direction. That was changed for all the right reasons. It was an amped up, supercharged version of what KISS had done before. It took those missteps and that state of complacency and creative gout leading to the elder to get us back on the right road. I don't think I have ever wanted success and an outlet for my musical creativity any more desperately than when I saw it slipping away. When I saw complacency and the poisons of success breaking my connection with what had made me want to be successful in the first place. The past 35 years of KISS wouldn't have happened had we not teetered so close to the edge. I have no regrets with KISS, none at all, because here I am, nearly 50 years later. A lot of people say they have no regrets as a way of being bullheaded. When I hear people say it, I get the impression that what they're really saying is, I don't make mistakes. Whereas I'm saying, I make mistakes, but the mistakes are still valuable. Mistakes got me here. What's the saying? Communism is the longest and most painful route from capitalism to capitalism. In the same way, that malaise we felt, or whatever was going on, was necessary to get KISS from where we were to here. It was a long route back to home, but we had to experience it. Why not? Chapter 6. Own your actions. Own your outcome. When I was younger, I had a lot of do's and don'ts. Rules about what I required of myself and others. During my teens and early 20s, what I regarded as acceptable behavior from people around me was so strict, so stringent. But I found that these parameters weren't based on life experience. My standards were based on some crazy notions that, as a kid, I had set up in my mind, all rooted in my limited experience of the world beyond my home. The rules had all been established kind of arbitrarily. Turns out we can't just conjure up those sorts of rules or parameters. We set ourselves up for misery or failure by expecting things of others that aren't realistic or that are based on fantasy. We have to experience life before we know what is and isn't applicable and positive for us. I made my life difficult and made having friends and socializing difficult by holding everybody to a standard, an inflexible, almost mechanical perfection that no one could reach. Any mistake somebody made or anything that somebody did that annoyed me was reason for expulsion from my circle. A girlfriend once said to me, "You're never going to be happy because you're too judgmental and expect too much from everybody." She was right. I wasn't happy. It's a bad idea to set up, even unknowingly, a situation where we're bound to fail. There's a difference between setting a higher bar and setting an impossible goal. That goes for everyone. One of the things I find interesting at this point in my life is to look back at times when I said things to friends and lovers and behaved in ways that, in hindsight, were appalling, but were very much in keeping with how my parents acted and spoke. It made it very difficult for some people to be around me, and it certainly affected some relationships. My mom sometimes said to me, or my dad or other people, "Who the hell do you think you are?" It's a horrible thing to say. But when I was young, I thought nothing of saying that too. If I was angry or somebody said something I didn't like or behaved in a way I didn't like, "Who the hell do you think you are?" It can be intimidating to hear something like that. And to make it worse, I said it like I was mad at the person. I knew that saying this was demeaning and dismissive, but I said it anyway. Another thing I remember saying in the course of arguments or conversation was, "This discussion is over." And it worked, sometimes. Though just as often the person would look at me and reply, "What, are you crazy? This discussion is not over." I should have looked at myself in the mirror and asked, "Who the hell do you think you are?" Part of the way I tried to establish a sense of security or safety was to hold people to my set standard, which was too rigid to be realistic. At the time, I felt there was safety in being able to decide boundaries, to decide how people could behave and what was acceptable and what wasn't. It gave me a sense of control over situations, though of course it was a false sense. One of the earliest times I can remember being forced to examine my own behavior, my own shortcomings really, was on a tour in 1979. A woman who was working backstage at the food service, where we could grab dinner, gave me an unexpected life lesson. I was with the band and some crew members, and we were teasing and making fun of some people as we ate. As this was going on, the woman became visibly upset. It was a strong emotional reaction. I would say she was truly aghast. "It's okay," I assured her. "They don't mind. They like it." I guess I was trying to dismiss the cruelty as part of the usual backstage antics. "That's not what matters," she said. You don't treat people the way they allow themselves to be treated. You treat people the way they deserve to be treated. You treat people with the respect you would expect. Her words were like a sledgehammer to my head, and to this day I've never forgotten them. The way she put it was so articulate and concise that I immediately got it. Not that I had ever seen myself as cruel, but I immediately realized that this behavior I had deemed acceptable was in fact totally unacceptable, and it took somebody pointing that out to me, pointing out my behavior, to give me an aha moment. The sentiment was, of course, something I certainly knew was right, but I'd never given it sufficient thought in the context of my own behavior. Me, the kid who'd been bullied in the schoolyard making fun of someone? What the fuck was I doing? I wouldn't want someone to do that to me, so why was I doing it to someone else? Once the woman voiced it in those words, I realized I had been wrong. It was valuable, constructive criticism. In a similar vein, it's interesting to be able to look back and see that I wasn't so innocent in dealing with girlfriends, wives, bandmates, whoever it may have been. On the 2017 Kiss cruise, I spent a little time with Peter Criss's ex-wife, Lydia. We had a Q&A panel with Lydia. Michael James Jackson, who produced Creatures of the Night and Lick It Up, and helped us get back on track in the 1980s, and our first security guy, Big John Hart. It was terrific, and people asked great questions. I hadn't seen Lydia in a long, long time. When she was married to Peter, we had a contentious or uncomfortable relationship at times, though certainly in hindsight, it wasn't one-sided. On the cruise, it would have been easy to avoid contact with her because of experiences decades ago. But it also would have been a missed opportunity. I had, after all, played a part in those strained relationships. I hoped that she wasn't the same person she was back then, and I know I'm not, so the idea of seeing somebody in a new light was intriguing. In the end, I wanted to see her, and it was indeed great to see her. It was rewarding and opened up far more avenues than living in the past would have. It's always great to have a chance to celebrate with somebody where we are today, rather than steep ourselves in the discord of where we once were. There's a coming together and a celebration of where the road has taken us. I almost wonder what I had been fighting about with people like Lydia. Sometimes we tend to get into the rhythm of doing something a certain way. To see her again, and instead give her a hug and introduce her to my family was awesome. And I think we both felt that way. That was also very much what I hoped for when the Kiss reunion happened with the founding band members in 1996. The idea, at least for me, was to take advantage of how we had grown individually so we could correct some of the mistakes and go forward. That hope turned out to be very short-lived. But I see a great potential for reward in revisiting old situations and old friends or people from our past after we have a new perspective. It can put to rest any doubts we have and allow us to reflect on what caused the problems in the first place. With closure, it's possible to remedy, rectify, and move on. It allows us to move on without the what-ifs, and I don't want what-ifs in my life. How I had seen Peter and Ace when they left the band was based not only on my perspective back then, but also on how I had affected them with my own behavior. So I thought it was worth taking a shot at healing. Not to take advantage of that possibility, if only to resolve a lot of questions, would have been a shame. Though some people didn't see the opportunity the same way. At the beginning of the tour, it felt like a new beginning, but that feeling didn't stick around. Of course, in the case of a band, any reunion is complicated by musical factors, too. When Peter came back into Kiss, he was born again. He was a born-again Kistian. He was joyous in knowing that he was back, and he seemed cognizant of the mistakes he had made. At the onset, he said that he would never make the same mistakes again. So his musical shortcomings wouldn't have been insurmountable if he had continued to be willing to work on his playing, which he was when he first came back. He was very open to adjustments. I don't want to say criticisms, but let's call them helpful directions. This was something he'd never been able to handle in the past. Unfortunately, things with Peter changed dramatically, almost overnight. Back in the 1970s, Bob Ezrin, who produced Destroyer, had gotten Peter to play things that should have been impossible for him, but Peter pulled them off. It goes back to the fact that we know how much something is worth to us by how hard we're willing to work for it. And once the reunion got underway, Peter wasn't willing to work to improve his playing. It descended into a destructive situation. I remember thinking, if you're John Bonham and you're a prick, that's one thing. If, on the other hand, you can barely play and you're a jerk, then what's the point? Of course, at the end of the day, the only person I can change is me. In a band, for it to work, everybody has to do their job and contribute what's necessary to make it work. When someone doesn't do that, I can't do it for them. I can't do it for them any more than I can make up for what the other person in any kind of failed relationship isn't doing. With Peter, ultimately, it wasn't about his not being able to play. It was about why he wasn't able to play. It was about him as a person. His failure to commit to being the best he could be. His lack of wanting to do the work. That is much more the point. And to some extent, the same was true of Ace. Again, the same resentments that plagued the early days of the band resurfaced, and those resentments came from internal factors. I just became the target, the personification of whatever those guys were dealing with on a personal level. Throughout the reunion, Peter felt that the room service people treated him disrespectfully. He went right back to finger-pointing and blaming everyone else. You'd think most hotels hired their staff based on their ability to be disrespectful to Peter Criss, because he found such people in every hotel in the world. What could we do about that? I believe that if we all had been committed to bettering ourselves as musicians and working as a team, if we all had understood our place on the team and worked individually to be better at what we did, maybe we could have continued. When Ace and Peter were out of the band, the remaining members had taken the band down to the dirt and built it back up. So there was no way Ace and Peter were going to return and have everything as it once was. Plus, during those years, the non-makeup years, I learned a lot of aspects of the business and touring that I hadn't known before. So for Ace and Peter to come back and be considered equals was ridiculous. It was so unfortunate when they became more concerned with how much money I made versus how much they made. A whole lot of people in the world are richer than I am, but it doesn't eat at me at all. They were sad, but I don't cry about it. Still, it was terrific to get back together because it put to bed any doubts or thoughts I'd had about possibilities. Without the reunion, I would have had to live with those thoughts, but I've been sleeping real soundly since then, I can assure you. I'll drag something as far as I can, but at some point I know there's no point in dragging it any farther. When is it enough? When it's enough. It's just that simple. I got to a point where I was confident that the band wasn't failing because of me. I'd pushed it in a different direction, and since it was still failing, despite my efforts to be different, then it wasn't due to me. I was certainly cognizant of what the band had dealt with before, my shortcomings and inflexibility, my insecurities and defenses, but by 1996, 15 to 20 years later, I was a different person. From the beginning, the original thinking behind Kiss was that the four of us didn't have to do an equal amount of the work. We each just had to give 100% of what we were capable of. That might not be the same thing within any given song, and certainly not within the band as a whole. We weren't all the same when it came to how much we each contributed creatively to the music, or to the overall image or staging, but for us to share equally, we had to contribute as much as each of us was capable of contributing. And once again, those guys were not doing that. But again, does anything bad ever happen? I don't think so. We dealt with crisis management as time went on. I'm sure that Ace and Peter, at this point, are either baffled by or dismissive of how we have evolved and what Gene and I have reached in our lives, but the irony is that without the two of them, there would be no today. Even so, they had to realize that what's true today isn't necessarily true tomorrow. Being in a band isn't a birthright. When KISS started out, we believed it was all for one and one for all, and that was the way it would remain until the end. Well, that's fine, until you don't believe it anymore. Then what do you do? Do you take your ball and glove and go home? That's for each person to decide. I was in a band with three other guys who shared a sense of camaraderie and commitment to this force called KISS. Like a lot of things in life, I assumed that was forever. Marriage is often the same way. What happens when forever comes to an end? I refuse to let anyone else decide my fate. I refuse to let anyone else decide my life experience because we get only one shot at this. I refuse to let a bad bandmate shut down a good band. I refuse to let a bad marriage negate the potential for a good one. I refuse to let a bad marriage make me cynical about the ideals of a great marriage. Each person has to make their own rules to live by. And, as I've said, seek to revise and improve those rules on the basis of their experience. If someone doesn't want to play within the rules, then find someone else to play with. I was stunned when a therapist said to me once, "If you're working really hard in a relationship, you're in the wrong relationship." I was like, "What? It's that simple?" Yep. And I don't think family gets a free pass. The fact that you share common blood with somebody shouldn't allow that person to taint, compromise, or detract from your life. This is the only life I will have, as far as I know. So I don't care whether it's a sibling, a mother, a father, or another relative. Bringing something in that pollutes or dilutes my experience or the experience of people I care about is unacceptable. If you have to work at a relationship too much, you're in the wrong relationship, no matter what. We all make things much more complex than they need to be sometimes. As opposed to the complicated and unrealistic rules I tried to impose when I was younger, this is something incredibly simple and totally based in common sense and reality. Part 2. Relationships and Family. Chapter 7. Live for Others and Live Forever. These days, because my frame of mind is different, I'm able to think about the positive things I took from my childhood, maybe in an effort to understand in as much detail as possible how I can best support my own kids. I also think that when we go through the process of deprogramming or unlearning, we can look at the past in a new way, and the negative aspects of it don't maintain the same hold over us that they used to. I remember my mom would scratch my back when I was little, and nothing felt better than that. She had a way of scratching my back that nobody else could replicate. She also used to rock me to sleep sometimes, and I loved being on her lap. I identify very much with some of my mom's food, too. When I make meatloaf for my kids, I always say to them, "You know who made great meatloaf? Omi." It's interesting to realize the conflicting ways my mom has lived on in my life. Again, my parents may have trampled on their kids a bit, but I don't think it was ever consciously intended to hurt. It was what they'd experienced growing up, The ideology that you don't make your kids feel too comfortable or too complimented or give them too much approval, because withholding all of that will toughen them up. And I laugh because I know the best way to toughen kids up is to make them feel secure. There was always an awkward disconnect between my parents and me. Even so, they were very much about being there for me. They may have been inconsistent and erratic because of their histories, but unlike a lot of parents, they always said, even when I was adult, you can call us at any hour. That was not the case with many people I knew. Their parents would tell them not to call after 10 p.m. My parents? I remember calling them in the middle of the night. Despite whatever they lacked, they were there for me in the best ways they could be. And that's important. When I split up with somebody in my early 30s and was pretty broken up, my mom came into the city to see me. It was an odd juxtaposition. Despite their shortcomings, my parents were always concerned for me. When I was going through my divorce in the late 1990s, I called my mom and sobbed on the phone. So I have to say that despite all the odd or unhealthy aspects of our relationship, my parents were there in ways a lot of parents are not. I certainly often focus on their deficiencies, but they both had another side that was very committed and devoted. And that's the side I wish to emulate. I hope, without the rest. This comes back around to the idea that we never die, because who we are lives on, for better or worse, in our children and their children. Who we are and who we become has consequences. How we live matters because it's what we pass on to our children and those around us, and it's what outlives us. My mom's spirit lives on in what I carry of her. I can't make meatloaf without thinking of her. I can't eat it without thinking of her. I made it during one of my dad's recent visits, and it was clear to him what it meant. So yeah, I carry the good and the bad. The bad I've come to terms with, and the good I embrace fondly. I certainly hold memories dear that keep my mom alive for me. Still, though I don't quite understand it, I don't find myself missing her. Before she died, I was afraid of her passing away, and then it turned out differently than I'd expected. Her death was huge the day it happened, of course. It was life-changing. We are always our parents' children. But ever since she's been gone, I haven't missed her. Physically, she's not here, but whatever I got from her is. So for some reason, the only void I feel is that I don't get to see her. But that's the only thing that's changed. What I experienced with her is all still here. When my dad's gone, it will be much tougher, because I still have a connection to my parents through him. The more profound loss is when both parents are gone, because then we're orphans. No matter how old we are, we're then children without parents. Once my dad's gone, I fear I'll become what we all really are inside, a kid. And at that moment, we are children who have been abandoned, for lack of a better word. That eventuality is something I wrestle with. I'm well aware with all my children at their various stages of development in life that I'm an integral part of who they are and who they will become, and I embrace my role. There's comfort in knowing that my path to immortality will be paved by helping my children find their own road. It's hard for people to think of the world without them or of no longer existing. Most religion, as it's written and articulated, is just a way for people to come to grips with the finality of life. I don't have a problem with that because, in my mind, people continue to exist. Stories of an afterlife may help people in their struggle with the idea of the world without them, but guess what? The world existed before we were here, and it will continue without us. We leave our mark, and at least for me, that provides a sufficient sense of comfort. There's consolation in knowing that we continue. though that didn't come into play for me until I had children. Until then, I used to wonder what life was about. What was the point? Well, now I know the point is what we do in our lives and what we leave behind. That is very calming, and has put a lot of my questions to rest. So, in the same way, my mom and dad continue on through a meatloaf recipe, or memories of my back being scratched, or going to a museum. They are both still with me. And because of how involved I am with my children, and I see it already with Evan because he's older, I know I'll be there that much more. We get out of something what we put into it, and what we put into our children is paramount to who they become and how much of us continues in them. In that way, we are linked. They know it, and we know it. Evan and I are very close because of things we've gone through and spoken about and shared. That started at an early age, and I already see instances of this in Colin, Sarah, and Emily as well, in the questions they ask and how Aaron and I respond. They are all a continuation of our input, our influence, our spirit. That's really what this is all about. Our spirit lives on in those around us, in the people we affect the most. Obviously for me, children are a part of that equation. But we live on, too, through interactions with non-family members, through things we do for others. We can never do too much good, and each time we do good, there are two beneficiaries, the person we help and ourselves. Yeah, I know, it sounds corny. If somebody said this to me 20 or 30 years ago, I would have thought it was dopey. But perhaps as we move farther down the conveyor belt, we start to figure out what the end game is. And it really is true that helping other people achieve their goals or helping them through their struggles means they carry us with them. When we do something good for someone else, they remember it. The greatest thing I did in life was to stop being judgmental, stop judging, and stop being intolerant or unsympathetic. Once I let go of those things, the world looked better. It looked less ominous. And it looked less menacing and ugly. Doing something like that adds a whole existential aspect to the concept of taking pride in what we do and doing things for the sake of our own personal edification. There's a kind of cosmic scope to it as well, because it's not all for nothing. That's what I used to believe. And a lot of people probably also believe that it's all for nothing. What's the point? Well, it turns out that the point is that we can make our mark, a mark that will keep us present beyond the time we're here on Earth. It's impossible for us to live forever, but our spirit can, through what we impart to the people around us. Chapter 8. Life becomes worthwhile when we make others feel worthwhile. They say that the two most important days in our lives are the day we're born and the day we find out why. And that's a great insight. Except there's no single day that we find out why. Life tells us why in an ongoing way. Experiencing life and taking it all in is a continuous process. Certainly having children was a major defining moment in my life because it made clear to me that being a parent, being a good parent, being a father, might be the most important reason I was born. Though parenting, too, is a process that evolves. Just as we never arrive in life, we never arrive as parents either, and our dreams and goals shift as a result of circumstances and experience. Throughout the course of being a parent, I've had the sense of its importance reaffirmed. If we are consciously aware of our actions, we will constantly fortify, reevaluate, and acknowledge our purpose. Over time, various ways I have either protected or steered my children and continue to do so are added to the answer to the question of why I'm here. Even the idea of being a parent changes. Some people think that being a parent is about being present and providing for their children. But how do we define that? No one has to be a parent to feed someone, for example, so that can't be the root of it. I was talking to my daughter, Sarah, recently, and I suddenly said, "I can't believe I'm your father." I've said this to her before. I say it to all my kids. What I mean is that I'm so blessed to have been able to reach this point. When we set goals related to how we want to succeed in life, we never understand the full scope of life's possibilities. We can only imagine what we can comprehend. The joy of being a parent and seeing these people who are part me is mind-blowing. There's an incredible primal component to being a parent, and part of the power I feel is from something that is not a conscious decision. It transcends that. It's the essence of religion and spirituality. The ultimate affirmation of life is birth. Although I can't articulate it, what's so stunning is to suddenly understand the meaning of life and how life is perpetuated and how, in essence, we never really die. We are the remnants of our parents, and we continue on through our children. This realization was so enormous in scope to me that, again, it opened a door to something I didn't even know existed, the potential to give a child everything I didn't have, and also to heal myself by doing it. There is a reciprocal joy. I've made the conscious decision that the best way to lead is by example. I become a better person when I make sure I'm not only honest with myself, but also honest with my children. I ask myself, is this behavior I could explain to my children? Thinking this way eliminates many moral dilemmas. It's a simple gut check. Even if I didn't have kids, I could apply the same thinking in a more general way. Is this behavior I could honestly defend to future generations? A tobacco company once offered KISS sponsorship and much-needed financial compensation at a time when we were trying to rebuild the band during personnel changes and upheaval and our money was dwindling. But if we had accepted that money, how could I explain that to my children? We passed. At a later point, someone was interested in partnering with me to create a coffee table book of porn stars. And I thought about it. No matter how I window dressed it, it again kept coming back to one thing. How could I explain this to my children? Well, I couldn't. So, it was another no. In the case of porn, specifically, people had to decide for themselves whether or not it works for them. But for me, the book would have been legitimizing something I wasn't comfortable with, and I would have been doing it because money was involved. I want my children to know that money can't change my values. If I'm hoping they will emulate what I say, they should also be able to see that I back it up with what I do. What we do inspires people much more than what we say. That didn't resonate with me until I got older, but now it's my mantra with raising kids. Lead by example. It's not what I say. It's what I do. Or as I heard another parent say, "I'm watching your feet, not your mouth." Sometimes people look at couples who don't have children and think, "Oh, isn't that sad?" Well, who's to say? Nobody is automatically a good parent. We don't automatically give our children what's best for them, even if, as it was with my parents, we have that intention. Not everyone automatically puts their children before themselves. Some people are too selfish to do so. I certainly don't think that just by having a child we necessarily develop those desires or drives. My childhood led me to look for ways to validate myself because I didn't get sufficient validation at home. Now, as a father, I think it's important to tell my children I'm proud of them when they succeed at something. But it's also important, very important, to say to them, "How does it make you feel?" That is, to put them in touch with their own feelings, so they're not dependent on my approval as much as their own. As Colin and Sarah have already shown themselves to be terrific students, with test scores and grades I certainly never had, my saying, "Boy, that is really terrific," has led to, "How does that make you feel? Does it feel good to do such a good job?" I want all my children to realize that doing well makes them feel good, as opposed to just making me proud. I want to stress the internal rewards of doing a good job, not just the external praise. Positive reinforcement is great, but equally important is to teach children that success feels inherently good. Accomplishments should make them feel good, and it's not as necessary for them to get the approval of someone else as it is for them to feel their own approval. I regard this as extremely important with my children. It's important to me that I tell them this because I didn't hear it when I was a child. But again, it's also important to say, "How do you feel?" That connects the dots for them. It makes my dad feel good, but I feel really good too. I've always wanted to give my children something wonderful, to help them appreciate the things I appreciate. Validation comes in so many forms. Recently, Colin was gazing out our bedroom window and said to me, "Dad, look at that beautiful sunset." I knew that we, as his parents, were making that crucial difference. I must be doing something right if my children see the beauty in the world around them that other people miss. That's life-affirming to me. That means I'm going to leave something behind that's better than who I am. A couple of years ago, I was telling someone that my adult son, Evan, was very grounded, very socially conscious, very cognizant of his obligations to the world and to society. Then I added, all things I was clueless about at his age. Evan is so far beyond who I was in my early 20s. At 9, Sarah has compassion and empathy for others that is deeply touching, and it's the result of her processing what she has seen at home and embracing it in her own way. Emily, at 7 years old, has a grasp of social interactions and a confidence that makes her one of the funniest and most joyous children I've ever seen. The fact that others agree, and that she is mine, only deepens the profoundness. These qualities had no bearing in my life when I was younger, but all this is the ultimate reward, the ultimate measure of my own life. I'm doing something right, and that's life-affirming. Look, everybody thinks their children are special. When other people tell you your children are special, there's something rewarding about that. Those accolades mean a lot to me. I love it when somebody comes over to my family in a restaurant and says, "You're a great dad." Well, I know that, but it's also nice to have it recognized. As I said before, I don't believe trying to be a great parent is universal. I've seen a mom look at her child, who couldn't have been more than 5 years old, and say, "You make me sick." So, no, I don't give that credit to everybody. Having a child doesn't automatically make anyone a great parent. For me, parenting has to do with giving my children what I craved and wanted so desperately when I was young. Not material things, but a sense of worth, a sense of joy in the world, a sense of no judgment. All things I wasn't given. I have an opportunity to shape my children in a way I wasn't, and to reap the rewards of doing that. Because I believe we heal ourselves when we do good for others. When it comes to living on in another generation, I'm happy that the things I've been able to learn, independent of my parents, are now getting passed down. I'm breaking the cycle. It's not necessarily analogous, but a child who has been abused has 2 choices, to become an abuser or to be the opposite. I know what I saw. I know how I was treated. I am determined to take a different road with my kids. Sometimes I'm stunned by what I see out there. I'm stunned when parents still put themselves in one way or another before their kids. I can't fathom that. I see people who say they put their children first, but then they qualify it. Don't qualify it. Put your children first. I want to be the best parent I can for my kids. I expect that from myself. When my younger son, Colin, says to me, "You're the best dad in the world," I say, "That means a lot to me. I try." Mind you, most kids will say their parents are the best in the world, but I want my son to know I work at it. I try. I want to be the best parent. I want him to know that it's not something I take lightly. That's different from a lot of other people, and the rewards are so much greater. It removes a lot of the chance in how children will turn out, because the children are being guided and fueled by their parents. Yes, children will be who they are, and each one will be different, but children start life as a blank slate, and we parents are the ones who do the initial writing on it. We give our children the values they start out with, and we can save them a lot of trouble if those values are worthwhile. We're not going to change our children's personalities or their aspirations, but we clearly give them their code of honor, their ethics, their morality. We can spell that out to them, or they can see it in action. I want to make sure my children see it in action. One thing that's particularly important to impart to children is the difference between tolerance and acceptance, because I want to help my kids be non-judgmental and empathetic. I know there's been a sort of movement built around the idea of tolerance, but I'm not interested in tolerance. Tolerance isn't what's called for. Acceptance is. Embracing. We tolerate pain. We tolerate sadness. But that's not the same as willingly accepting something. Acceptance is a choice we make. Tolerance is a good legal standard so people can't discriminate. But I want something on a more personal level. It's a bit like the difference between what is lawful and what is ethical. People can stay on the right side of the law, can stand up and say, "I didn't break the law," but then do some horrifically unethical things. I'm not interested in teaching my kids to tolerate differences in other people. I want to teach them to accept and embrace those differences. Anyone can quote from the Bible, and you can find anything you want there, from brutality to kindness. But anybody who uses the Bible as grounds for either hatred or intolerance, or tolerance with the belief that someone is going to hell, doesn't make the world a better place. I found in my life that being kind and accepting, and understanding how difficult life can be for others, and how we all deserve to be loved and happy, makes life so much better. To give that to my children early in their lives, as opposed to letting them stumble through life the way I did, is a gift to them and to me. To carry around hatred or intolerance or judgment is ugly. The bottom line is, who are we to judge other people? Who are we, for instance, to decide or to pass judgment on who anyone can love? We're blessed to find love. If my kids see somebody who's different from the norm, I make sure to tell them to imagine how difficult that person's life is, how brave that person has to be. If we see a homeless person on the street, I remind my kids that that person was also once a child in school who dreamed of being president or a star. I want to break everything down to its most human form. I want all my children to know it's okay to feel pain. It's okay to hurt. It's okay to cry. I've done all that. Only weak people don't. Strong people do. I'm real clear on my job. When baby birds leave the nest, they have to be ready, and they have to have knowledge. We should set them up to be able not only to handle life, but also to embrace it. Not to go out there and battle. It shouldn't be a battle out there. We should give our kids the tools to go out and enjoy life, to be suitably educated to deal with whatever they need to deal with, and believe that they can. It's what we owe them. And if we don't do that, they'll suffer for it. I've always found that I'm most effective in conversations with people when I just relate what I've done. Maybe that information will enlighten them. Maybe it will give them some glimmer of how to apply the same things to their own lives. But I'm not in any position to tell anybody how to live, including my children. When Evan reached an age where I thought we needed to talk about drugs, I didn't say to him, "Don't do drugs," although I certainly believe that. I thought the most effective way to talk to him was to let him know in more practical terms what doing drugs can lead to. "Remember so-and-so? He's dead. Remember so-and-so? He's broke." Basically, here's the lay of the land, here are the tools, now you decide. I continue to follow this same approach in many different forms, and the results are resoundingly evident in who my children are, how they see the world, and how the world sees them. Chapter 9. The boundaries we inherit limit the distance we can